It was Warrior Week with dueling Ultimate Warrior documentaries on A&E and Vice TV. I think if you were to fuse the two of them together, you would have had a fuller look at his life. Still incomplete. There were a lot of things that were left out of both specials. But having watched both of them, I thought the A&E biography was the stronger of the two. I thought the Dark Side of the Ring special was not one of the stronger episodes they've done, although it had its moments. There were really, if you look at these two together, it was the tale of two wives. Warrior's wife Dana was all over the A&E special, while his first wife Shari dominated the Dark Side episode. And that's the one that I will begin with, is the Dark Side of the Ring episode on the Ultimate Warrior. The two of them were married before Warrior got into wrestling in 1982, all the way through 1991, and his entire peak run with WWE. On the whole, I thought she was very complimentary of Warrior. Certainly not the smut and filth that Dana Warrior talked about when she responded to a comment that somebody left on Instagram, and she said that she had no part in the project, and she called it smut and filth without even having seen it. I'm sure she heard that his ex-wife was interviewed and thought that that's what it would be, but it really wasn't. She talked about how he originally had dreams of being a chiropractor. He ended up in bodybuilding, and clearly being a scrawny kid motivated him to change his body. But one of the biggest takeaways from both docs is that he wasn't really passionate about any one thing. He really just wanted to make a lot of money and be successful. He was never married to the pro wrestling business the way that others are sort of obsessed with it. You know, they say, oh, once it's in your blood, you can't get it out. I mean, it's true that he, you know, would leave and come back, and he would leave and come back. And so his life is going to be defined by his pro wrestling career, not his, you know, his days in bodybuilding. But he was not obsessed with wrestling. He was obsessed with making money. That was really his driving force. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think in hearing people, you know, kind of talk about what was important to him and all of the different disputes that he had at various points in his career, that's really sort of how he measured things. They covered he and Sting coming together as a tag team in wrestling. Jim Cornette talked about how awful they were early on in Memphis, and he made it very clear from the get-go he was not a fan of the Ultimate Warrior. In case you were wondering what his opinion of the man was, wonder no more. They went to Mid-South, which is where they had their run as the Blade Runners, and Jim Ross just buried the shit out of him, saying that he's never met or seen a wrestler with less ability than the Ultimate Warrior. They interviewed David Manning about Warrior's time in World Class as the Dingo Warrior. Manning was a referee, promoter, and booker for Fritz Von Erich. Nobody knew what the hell a Dingo Warrior even was. When he got to WWE in 1987, Shari says that Vince McMahon did not like the Dingo Warrior name. Of course he didn't, because he didn't know what the fuck it meant. Can you blame him? So he ends up as the Ultimate Warrior, which is a much better name. He's the Ultimate Warrior from Parts Unknown. And you know, as a kid, Warrior was not my favorite. Although I did have his wrestling buddy for some reason. I don't know. My brother had Hogan, and I had the Warrior wrestling buddy. Those wrestling buddies were big back then. They even talked in, I don't know if it was this one or the other one. I think it was in this one. There was a picture of him holding up his wrestling buddy and how proud he was of it. And it was a big deal. I guess even to the wrestlers, it was a big deal back then. But, you know, even though he wasn't my number one favorite, when you're a kid, the guy just looked cool. The name, the bright colors with the tassels and the physique, the wild hair, the intensity, the music. I mean, you want good gym music to go work out to, you play that Ultimate Warrior theme song. That'll get your heart rate up. But when Warrior started doing the whole shaking the ropes thing, there were agents who told him, oh, this is dumb. Don't do it. It's not going to get over, which pretty much shows what they knew. Yeah, but it's like the promos. They were completely nonsensical. Even his ex-wife said that he would crack himself up sometimes with the things that he would say. They wouldn't make any sense. And he knew it didn't make any sense. But to kids, that didn't matter. So you can see why a guy like him would get over so huge. Jake the Snake Roberts was interviewed. He called Warrior a complete jerk in the ring. Cornette said Bobby Heenan was not a fan of his after Warrior hurt his neck when they worked together, probably in those weasel suit matches they had together, because Warrior and Bobby worked together quite a bit. Bobby had a bad neck going back to an injury in Japan back in the early 80s. After Heenan told Warrior one night that he had hurt him, Warrior just sort of shrugged it off, like it didn't even matter. But Shari said that it bothered him to hear the boys talk about what a shitty worker he was. She said they didn't know that he had a sensitive side. He was very insecure. His father left when he was either 10 or 12 years old. I've heard both numbers given. And he was cheating on his mother with one of their neighbors, and this apparently traumatized him. She said Warrior had an anxiety disorder for years, which backs up what was talked about on the A&E special when they showed copies of forms that he had to fill out at the time for, I guess it would have been WWE's drug program, showing that he was taking all of these anti-anxiety medications. Like, at first, he was only taking Motrin, and then over a period of time, he added all of these different medications that he was taking, you know, to the list. So, you know, he put a lot of pressure on himself as he was pushed, you know, upwards to the very top of the card. And they talked about the face-off that he had in the 91 Rumble match with Hulk Hogan, which, again, if you were a kid and you were a young WWE fan at the time, that was huge. You know, seeing Hogan and Warrior, the two biggest baby faces in the company, come nose to nose. And that little sequence they did in the Rumble match, that was a huge moment. That leads into talk about WrestleMania 6. And Shari said the Warrior loved that he was going to be taking Hogan's spot in the company. Hogan does the job, and Warrior is anointed the new champion. He's the guy in WWE. And that match between Hogan and Warrior at WrestleMania 6 is, you know, again, if you were a Hulk Hogan fan or an Ultimate Warrior fan, there were a lot of friends divided at that time. Because you were either one or the other, right? You were on one side of the fence or the other. We had never had a WrestleMania main event like that before, where it was two big baby faces going one-on-one. And it was not something that Vince McMahon clearly liked doing, because how many big babyface versus babyface matches can you think of from that era in WWE that were promoted? I'm not saying it never happened on any show, but certainly not on a big show. Or a big pay-per-view. It was a very big deal. I would even say to like the younger me, Hogan Warrior WrestleMania 6 is what I think Austin Rock was to a younger generation at WrestleMania 17. Just that big, epic match between two baby faces, one-on-one, WrestleMania main event for the championship. I mean, I think that's a fair comparison to make. Jim Ross says that Hogan, what he did at WrestleMania was a miracle. He carried the Warrior to a great match. And, you know, it's true that Warrior's best matches came against great workers like Randy Savage, Rick Rude. I mean, Warrior, the best match that Ultimate Warrior ever had in his life was the WrestleMania 7 match with Macho Man Randy, or Macho King, I guess, Randy Savage. But one of the other greatest matches that he ever had was the rematch with Rick Rude for the Intercontinental title at SummerSlam in 89. That was a great match. But Savage was a great worker, Rude was a great worker, and as heels, they could bump around for the babyface and make them look better than they actually were. Hogan, you know, Hogan wasn't technically sound, but, you know, Hogan, he didn't have to be. He was still a good worker. He didn't have to be the most technically savvy guy in the ring. That's not what fans expected out of a guy who calls himself the Ultimate Warrior. That's not what fans expected out of Hulk Hogan. And Hogan was smart enough to know that. You know, when he would go over to Japan, it was like he was a totally different worker. But, you know, look, it is true that Warrior's best matches did come in the ring against guys who were better than him. Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, those guys had to get over as great wrestlers because they weren't big like Hogan and Warrior were. And that was just a different time. You weren't going to be able to get over the way those guys did just by being big. You know, for better or worse, expectations change over time. So it was a lot harder for those guys, I think, to kind of get over and get to that level because they were always being compared. And it's probably the same way today with wrestlers who are always compared to Austin and Rock and Michaels and Bret or people that they remember as being big when they were younger or that they remember when wrestling was hot in the late 90s. So that's why it was a case where Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, they had to be technically sound because they were only 6 feet tall. You know, if that in some cases. Hogan, Warrior, these guys were jacked to the gills. They didn't have to worry about that. They just had to look the part. They looked like comic book characters come to life. But I do think Warrior deserves a little more credit than some of these talking heads give him. Because even though he was in the ring with these, you know, great workers or, you know, very good workers, he still got to know what to do in the ring. You can't have two left feet. He played his part well. He held up his end of the bargain, and he was part of those matches, just like Macho Man was and just like Rude and Hogan were. The Warrior was on the other side of the ring. So I will defend him to a degree and say that I do think he deserves a little more credit than a lot of people give him. Now, after he won the championship from Hogan, Sherry said that he changed for the worse. He seemed altered. She would call his hotel room. He wouldn't answer. So he would have the hotel do a wellness check. And they would say, oh, you know, he's there. He was just sleeping. And she called back one time and he answered the phone and she heard a woman's voice in the background. And she just lost it. And then she checked his day planner and found the names of women for each town that he was in, which then led to her serving him divorce papers. And Dave Meltzer was interviewed and he said that he didn't say this on the special, although he was interviewed on the A&E special, but he had mentioned that the woman that Warrior mostly traveled with the year that he was champion, which was 1990, was the future Melanie Pillman. So it may well have been her, the female voice that Sherry heard in the background. I mean, the timeline would match up. It's certainly possible. But I remember reading that years ago, that Warrior dated Brian Pillman's future wife, and then after they broke up, he would still call and pester her. He could not understand how she would leave him to be with a small man like Pillman, who at the time was basically a cruiserweight. He was a light heavyweight in WCW. And Pillman apparently wanted to fucking kill him for it, and never had the chance because they never worked in the same company at the same time. You know, I guess in 96, I guess that would have been the closest that they came, right? Because Pillman signed with WWE in probably June of 96. And that was Warrior's last month in his last run there before they fired him. But by that point, it probably was old news. The two of them just never crossed paths. But I do believe if Brian Pillman was, you know, that upset, even though he was a smaller man, if he wanted to kill the Warrior, he would have fucked him up. Now, he might have had to take a tire iron to do it. But Pillman, I'm sure Pillman could hold his own. Pillman was a tough guy. Pillman went through 30 fucking throat surgeries as a kid. Small as he was, played in the NFL, went through a lot of physical trauma in his life. I think he could have held his own. But it's just funny, you know, talk about small world, that was who the Warrior was with long before Pillman was. But Jake was talking about how he was told he was going to be paired off with a Warrior in a championship program. And, you know, look, I don't know. A lot of what Jake said didn't really add up to me. And it could just be that he's misremembering certain things, or it could just be that he's full of shit. I don't know. Maybe a little bit of both. But, you know, he talked about one story where Vince McMahon said, yeah, you're going to work with him, but you got to go get Warrior's blessing first. Go get his permission. He had to go to the locker room to get Warrior's blessing to work with him, which that doesn't make any fucking sense, but okay, let's go with it. And he claims that he went into Warrior's private dressing room and Warrior was completely just negative on the whole thing and basically yelling at him and talking down to him and saying, I don't care about you or your family or, you know, anything like that. I just care about me. And I want to make sure that my shit is taken care of. And he threw Jake out of the dressing room and all he cared about was money. And I have a very hard time visualizing this in my head, but this is what Jake claims. This is what Jake says is the source of his, or was the source of his hatred for the Warrior. He said it was like somebody pissing in his mouth. Can always rely on Jake Roberts to come up with the very classy analogies. But he wanted the run. He wanted to work with the Warrior because he knew that for him, it was going to set him up. It was going to make a lot of money. It was going to be huge for his career. And he says it was all set for after SummerSlam. But again, the timeline just doesn't work out. If he's talking about a championship run, Warrior, by the time he was seemingly being programmed with Jake, Warrior wasn't the champion anymore. This was like a year later. They did do the vignettes in the summer of 91, which was what led to the Jake heel turn, where Warrior had come to him for advice and he made Warrior do these weird, you know, things to learn the ways of the Snake Man or whatever. And remember the fake snake that bit, you know, Warrior on the cheek? This is what led to the Jake heel turn. It did seem like they were setting up to work together, but by that point, Warrior was not a number one. He was not the champion. He was never going to be a top, like the very top program for the title. So I think Jake is just getting his lines crossed up there. But even though his first marriage was over, it was not, you know, acrimonious. He still confided in his first wife because he felt that he could trust her. And obviously he had major trust issues with a lot of people, and she was still someone that he felt he could trust. And he confided in her about the letter and showed her the letter that he was preparing to send to Vince McMahon. He wanted to lay down an ultimatum to Vince that he felt he deserved to be paid exactly the same thing that Hogan was paid, which was in excess of $500,000. And a few weeks later, Vince agreed to all of his terms, which is true. There is a copy of the letter online that I think came out during later litigation between the two sides. Vince McMahon had agreed to everything the Warrior had asked for, every demand. But the only reason he did that was because he wanted him in the ring the following month as scheduled for the SummerSlam main event that he was already advertising. It was going to be Hogan and Warrior together against Sergeant Slaughter, Colonel Mustafa, and General Adnan. And the plan was get him to the garden, get him to the ring, let him do the match, and then I'm going to fire his ass. And as Warrior brawled to the back before the finish of the match, he came through the curtain, and as the story goes, McMahon handed him a letter, and he didn't really fire him. It was really technically a suspension. But that's the story that Vince McMahon tells anyway. Couldn't wait to fire him. That's what he said on the A&E special. I couldn't wait to fire him. But the thing is, Vince McMahon told everybody that Warrior held him up the night before the show. And that is not what happened at all. That is absolutely false. That's how it was portrayed on the A&E special. But, see, that's the drawback of the A&E stuff. You get the WWE sanitized version of events as gospel. But Warrior sent that letter to him a good month and a half before SummerSlam, and Warrior got what he wanted. This was not a case of 24 hours before the show, he held him up for money like Jeff Jarrett held up Vince McMahon for money in 99. That's not what happened here. But that is the WWE spin on what happened. But Vince McMahon, after he did kick him out, he did send him a very nasty letter saying the Warrior was a legend in his own mind. You are in no way the star that Hulk Hogan is and the household name that Hulk Hogan is. And that really hurt the Warrior's feelings, even though everything Vince said about the comparison of Hogan and Warrior at the time was not untrue. Warrior was not the star that Hogan was. Warrior did not draw the way that Hogan was. Warrior was not the mainstream name that Hulk Hogan was. All of that was true. But McMahon really went out of his way to be very cutting and very biting and very mean in the words that he used. You know, it's like, you can find really mean, nasty things to say to somebody. If you know somebody is very self-conscious, let's say about their weight, especially a woman, right? If you were to turn around and you don't even cuss or anything like that, but you just say, and you're really fat or you're really overweight, you could really stand to lose a few pounds. I mean, the impact that those words can have on somebody, it stays with you. I felt like you read the words he used in that letter and it's like he knew the buttons to push. He was really trying to get under this guy's skin. And he probably knew how self-conscious he was, and it was pretty rough what he said in that letter. But like I said, he was suspended. He wasn't technically fired. They did end up bringing him back the following year for the big return of WrestleMania 8 because Hogan was taking time off and they needed another top babyface. They glossed over the end of that run, which saw Warrior fired for importing human growth or growth hormone from overseas. I think there was a package that got intercepted by customs. So anyway, he was gone for a second time. And then in 1996, Vince McMahon brings the Warrior back again. It's like these two can't quit each other. Ross and Cornette, they talked about having to fly all the way to Arizona to Warrior's home to meet with him and listen to him wax on about this concept of destrucity, which was his idea of the truth between destiny and reality. He worked on a comic book that he wanted them to buy a bazillion copies of to sell, which they wouldn't do. They weren't interested in doing that. JR says that entire trip was time in his life that he can never get back. So Warrior goes to WrestleMania 12. He squashes a young Triple H. Completely no-sells the pedigree. Cornette sounded very upset about all of this, but the plan apparently was for them to have a 7-minute match. And Warrior was having none of that. Even Triple H, I think, has told the story. He did go to Warrior before the match. He had some ideas. And Warrior basically blew him off and said, no, we're going to do the match this way, and that's the way it's going to be. Period. End of story. Now, I don't think he needed to kill the guy's finish like that. But let's be honest. Why the fuck would Greenwich snob Hunter Hearst Helmsley go 7 minutes with the Ultimate Warrior? That is ridiculous. There is no way that match ever should have been that long. So they glossed over the reason for his leaving again, only that Vince decided to fire him and move on. There is blame to be had on both sides. When you look at things, as difficult as he was to work with, Vince McMahon brought this guy back twice after that initial run. And he tried to do it a third time in 1997, which never happened and was not mentioned in either documentary. But I know David Bixenspan, he included a copy of the letter a couple of years back in a Substack newsletter that he has called Babyface v. Heel. A little over a month after the Montreal Screwjob, Vince McMahon sent a letter to the Ultimate Warrior offering him a guaranteed $750,000 a year, plus royalties and a max of 14 days of work per month to come back to WWE. What's funny about that is that was only, I don't know, 3 months, maybe 2 or 3 months after Vince McMahon had gone to Bret Hart and said, look, I'm going to breach your contract because I can't afford to pay you. So I'm going to give you my blessing to go negotiate with Ted Turner and Eric Bischoff to go to WCW because I can't pay you. But of course, once Bret made the deal, Vince came back to him when they actually started making money because they jacked up the price of their pay-per-views when they went to 3 hours every month. And he said, oh, I can afford to pay you now. And Bret was like, I already made the deal. But you go from, I can't afford to pay my top guy on your contract, I'm going to breach it, to 3 or 4 months later, he's offering the Warrior, who seems impossible to work with, $750,000 a year to come back. I cannot even imagine what a shit show it would have been having the Ultimate Warrior coexist in the same locker room with drugged up Shawn Michaels as the champion. Can you imagine those two jockeying for the top spot in the company at the same time when Shawn was just in the midst of all of the issues and all of the bad things he was doing at the end of 97, beginning of 98? Years later, in a deposition, Vince McMahon was asked, why did you go back to the Warrior again in 97? And he said, I don't know. I guess I'm a glutton for punishment. Yeah, you think? He's as nuts as the warrior was. They interviewed Eric Bischoff for this, even though both documentaries completely skipped over his WCW run, which was a total disaster. So I'm not even sure why Bischoff was interviewed here. I mean, I guess he had brief interactions with Warrior when he was in WCW, but then why not cover his WCW time? They didn't mention it at all. So Warrior goes back to Arizona, he opens a gym, and he crosses paths with his ex-wife again. And they're both dating at that point. She says that she met her current husband at that gym, and Warrior met his wife Dana there. And they agreed that they should not be at the gym anymore, that she wouldn't go to the gym anymore because things might be awkward if the significant others know that, you know, they're seeing each other at the gym. And so they kind of came to an understanding on that. And she claims that Warrior apologized to her for not being faithful and thanked her for being a great wife. And she says that was the last conversation that they ever had. Again, very far from the smut and filth that Dana Warrior implied this Dark Side of the Ring special was going to be about. They did talk about Warrior going on to become a conservative speaker. They show him saying that his wife, Dana, was a conservative, and it made him realize that he was living a conservative life, which flies in the face of what she said in the A&E special, when she said, oh, well, you know, he got that way by listening to Rush Limbaugh. Cornette calls him a far right-wing nut that hated gay people, and we get the infamous UConn video, University of Connecticut appearance of, you know what, doesn't make the world work. And we got excerpts from old blog posts that his wife, I supposedly got taken down from his old website, where he rants on, and I quote, black skin kids behaving like animals, less than human, like rhesus monkeys, among other disgusting things that he said over the years. They talked about his Hall of Fame induction in 2014, him making peace with WWE and Jake Roberts. Now, this is a whopper as well. So Jake Roberts is there. He says that he had a roll of quarters in his pocket, and he was going to beat the Ultimate Warrior's ass. Warrior, he said, though, had all kinds of security with him, so he had to wait. He had to wait for his moment. And then all of a sudden, he gets a tap on the shoulder, and he turns around, and it's the Warrior. And the Warrior says to him, you know, I just want you to know, I apologize. And he goes into this whole thing about how sorry he was for the way he acted. And Jake says it totally disarmed him. Do I believe that Jake Roberts was standing there with a roll of quarters ready to assault the Ultimate Warrior on the night that he was being inducted into the Hall of Fame? Absolutely not. It's a nice story to tell, and I can definitely see if he had beef with Warrior before him wanting to confront him and say something to him about it and get some stuff off his chest. But do I think that Jake Roberts was going to attack him with a roll of quarters and, you know, put himself in a position where he could be blackballed for doing that from WWE? Absolutely not. I think that's complete bullshit. But after the Hall of Fame, you know, Warrior made that one brief appearance at WrestleMania 30 when they trotted out all the Hall of Famers. And then the next night on Raw, they said it was the next night after the Hall of Fame that he appeared on Raw. That's not true because WrestleMania was the next night. But the night after WrestleMania, Monday Night Raw, he comes down to the ring. And he cuts that promo where he clearly did not look all that well. Even JR says he looked unhealthy. And it was as if he knew that this was going to be his last appearance. It was as if he knew he was going to die. And they did address the fact that his grandfather, his father, both died in their 50s. They both died young. And that he was always cognizant of that and he was worried about that. He had to know that that was a possibility. And him doing all the drugs and steroids that he did over the years did not do his heart any favors. So he had to know. I refuse to watch that back. It's just so fucking eerie. And the words that he said talking about, you know, his heart beating its final beat and when, you know, a man breathes his final breath, just the things that he said, the dialogue. And then the next day, he drops dead. It's just too eerie. He had to have some kind of premonition. 12 hours later, drops dead from a heart attack. Cornette said that it was startling. Here you have a guy who has a chance to make amends and get a new kind of lease on life, and then all of a sudden he turns around and he drops dead. And Jake Roberts ended the special by saying, "Rest in peace." Those were his final words to the Ultimate Warrior. I think that this would have benefited from another hour. I think this needed it more than the Brian Pillman episode did, honestly. They could have opened the season with this one as their two-parter. Grizzly Smith is on tap this week. Speaking of Jake, Jake's going to be all over Dark Side of the Ring this week. They talk about his father, Grizzly Smith. I mean, you talk about Dark Side of the Ring. I don't know if people are ready for this one. And then the following week, they end this part, this half of the season with Dynamite Kid before the show comes back later this year. Now let's switch over to A&E because they had a very similar in some ways, but also a very different take on the Warrior. We had interviews with Warrior's mother, Donna, and Chad, his official biographer. Apparently Warrior had an official biographer. Who knew? His old football coach, his high school friend Ryan, is interviewed as well. They all filled in the blanks for us on his blue-collar upbringing, living in a mobile home, and how his father left the family when he was a young boy, and that he didn't get the attention he needed. So this benefited by having access to more people who knew him when he was very young, and I did learn some things about him here that I didn't know about before. He gets into bodybuilding. They talk about the prevalence of steroids, which were still legal back then. You cannot tell the story of the Ultimate Warrior without talking about steroids. I mean, the man was a walking neon sign for steroid use. They showed footage of him backstage at a speaking event in 2008, claiming that he was 295 pounds before he ever touched a steroid. If you believe that, then I am 330 pounds of rock-hard muscle. I mean, if we're telling fairy tales, then why can't I get in on the fun too? Once he realized he wasn't going to make a lot of money doing bodybuilding, he ends up in pro wrestling. He's tagging with Sting. Warrior did not like the idea of paying dues. He thought, nobody looks like me. I should be making a lot of money. I should be the star. And they had footage from an old Sting interview, and he said Jim just wanted to go off on his own, and that's what he did. And after doing the Dingo Warrior thing in World Class, Vince McMahon snatched him up. Now, one of the talking heads in this special was a guy named Scott Yeager, who was listed only as podcaster. It's the only thing they put on the screen to identify him. Didn't even say what kind of podcast he does. Podcaster. I didn't know that was the only credential that you needed to be on one of these things. There's hope for me yet. They talked about Warrior feuding with Andre the Giant and how that means that you're going to be pushed up, you know, to the top of the card when you feud with Andre. And working with Andre makes you a household name if you win. And Sam Roberts talked about Hulk Hogan slamming and pinning Andre. That was what set Hulkamania in motion. And I laughed. come on. I mean, again, that's the WWE version of events. Hogan was obviously, he was already the champion for a number of years by that point. He had already been a major star, even outside of WWE. Vince McMahon mainstreamed Hulk Hogan. But even before Vince McMahon got his hands on Hulk Hogan, in wrestling, he was a major star. Once Vince got him, 84, 85, the stuff with Mr. T and Cyndi Lauper and WrestleMania, you know, he was co-hosting SNL and all the stuff that he was doing, he was already a mainstream name. So, yeah, again, the idea that it was pinning and slamming Andre that's what launched him into the stratosphere is comical. Warrior mentions that Andre, because they had Warrior audio spliced in here, Warrior said that Andre never did anything that he didn't want to do, and you know, it scared him when Andre told him to slam him, and they showed a few occasions where Warrior was able to slam Andre, and Peter Rosenberg was interviewed here, said that this is what put Warrior on Hogan's level, which is a more reasonable comment. Warrior had only been in the business for 5 years before Vince McMahon made the call for him to replace Hogan. He told Warrior at the end of 89 that he had He had chosen him. And he was going to be the one to take the mantle from Hogan. I'm sure that's a lot of pressure to put on somebody who's already high strung as it is. And there's a lot of resentment there too, I'm sure, from the other wrestlers who already don't like the guy because they think he can't work, or he works too stiff, or he's a prick to people behind the scenes. So I'm sure this didn't ingratiate him to them anymore. But that wasn't the case with everybody. Kamala loved him. He told the story of being brought back to WWE in 1992. He told this in a shoot interview. And there were nights where, you know, Kamala would have to sleep in his rental car because it was too expensive to pay for a room on the road. You know, every night, the wrestlers are responsible for their own hotel and car rental fees. And look, I'm sure Kamala was not making that much money back then. 92 was a lean year for the company anyway. And he was never a top guy during that period. And he claims that Warrior felt so bad for him that he would let Kamala ride with him in his limousine. And one time he put him up in his own, you know, really fancy hotel room at the Hilton or the Hyatt or one of those, you know, high-end places at the time. I don't know. He said that it was the limo the company was providing to Warrior while he was the champion, but that would have been in 1990. Kamala wasn't even in the company in 1990, so his timeline is all mixed up. But I want to be fair here and tell a positive Warrior story. A lot of people did not come away with a good impression of him when they worked with him or interacted with him, saw the way he would treat others. But in this case, Kamala had nothing but nice things to say about the way the Warrior treated him. So they too got into WrestleMania 6, the biggest match of Warrior's career. They had some very cool footage of Vince McMahon directing everybody during the contract signing that aired on the syndicated shows in the weeks leading up to WrestleMania. One of the other great benefits of them working with WWE on these specials is the access that they get to some of this footage that we have never seen before. And I'm going to get to more of that here in a second. That to me is what makes the A&E version stand out above the Dark Side of the Ring version in this case. Because of some of the footage that we were able to see here, I thought that was very cool. Paul Heyman was interviewed. He talked about the insane amount of pressure the Warrior had stepping inside the ring against Hogan. I'm assuming that's what he thought. I don't know how Paul Heyman would know that, seeing as how he wasn't in WWE at the time. But yes, I'm sure he was under a great amount of pressure going into that match and, you know, having to fill the shoes of Hulk Hogan. Hogan had been the golden goose. He'd been on top in that company for 5 years, 6 years. Those are big shoes to fill. It's like replacing Jim Ross on commentary. Michael Cole, when he did that in 2008, when he got thrust into that position, he never stood a chance. He was already handicapped from the first time he got put in JR's spot. Those are tough shoes to fill. Shane McMahon talked about that Warrior respected the business, and when he came back through the curtain, he broke down in tears, which is the same story that Pat Patterson used to tell. And Warrior, they had audio again and different parts from him, and he's talked about how he was emotional after the match, but within a couple of days, he was already asking the question, what's next? Now what? What comes after this? There was stuff I didn't like is that they talked about his title run in 1990 and why it wasn't a success. Because of his feuds with people like Rick Rude and The Undertaker and Jake Roberts. And again, a lot of that stuff did not happen during his run as champion. Him working with Jake, as brief as it was, that came in 91. His feud with The Undertaker, that came in 91. That did not happen when he was the champion in 1990. Undertaker didn't even come into the company until the end of 1990. So they completely screwed the pooch on the timeline when it came to some of this stuff. And blaming some of these programs for why Warrior's run as champion wasn't successful when they didn't even happen during his run as champion. But then came my favorite part of the documentary. And something that they had access to that the Dark Side of the Ring producers did not. Undertaker was telling a story of Warrior snapping at a kid at an airport. And how the kid's parents were well connected to WWE and they weren't happy about it. What it was is that the child was the son of the general manager of a television station that WWE did business with, and maybe their programming aired on that station. This is how Vince McMahon explained it in a deposition in 1999. So the general manager picked up the phone and called Joe Perkins. Joe Perkins was their syndication salesman at the time, and said goodbye. And Perkins tried to calm him down as he was embarrassed in front of his son, and Mr. Helwig agreed to, at the very least, do a videotaped, I'm sorry, you know, type situation where he objected to, which he objected to, obviously. It wasn't uncommon, you know, I mean, for Mr. Helwig from time to time to refuse autographs from kids or from anybody. He didn't like to do that and was often rude to fans. So that was Vince McMahon in that deposition. So Vince McMahon is not happy, and he wants Warrior to record an apology. And they showed the footage of them shooting the apology with Vince off camera directing the Warrior. And Warrior very clearly does not want to be there. He is in a bad mood. He starts cursing. He doesn't know what to say. Vince tells him, it's a fucking work. It's a work. That's it. And Warrior says, you know, I'm making an apology for something I didn't do. What are we doing here? And he keeps getting flustered and keeps, you know, fucking up and telling him, okay, start rolling again. And they try again and again. And finally, he gets it right. And he storms off as Vince McMahon thanks him. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jim. And he storms off. These could probably be, double as outtakes for John Cena's apology after that apology video to China that he filmed this week. But the apology is a bridge too far for the Warrior. This is what pushes him over the edge. And the next day he handwrites that letter I mentioned earlier to Vince McMahon. And they have David Shoemaker, who I guess is their resident historian on these things, reading from the letter, because Warrior wants everything that Hogan has. He wants Hogan money, he wants Hogan, you know, the cut of the merch and the pay-per-view and everything Hogan gets, he wants. And he's very upset about the video apology that Vince McMahon forced him to do. He's going to stay at home until Vince meets his demands. And Sam Roberts brings up that WWE had been promoting him for SummerSlam, and, you know, they were obviously between a rock and a hard place here. Peter Rosenberg says Vince McMahon is the last person that you know, want to bully around. And they had footage of Vince talking about the letter. He says it was a kick to the gut. He led Warrior to believe that they might be able to make a deal at the Garden that night, but he couldn't wait to fire him. And back, you know, to what I said before, this whole notion that Warrior held him up or whatever the night before, it's all bullshit. It's all nonsense. And there's court documents to back it up. But it's SummerSlam. Sergeant Slaughter is interviewed here. It's SummerSlam. It's the night of the big event. He says Vince McMahon told them that Warrior was holding him up for $500,000. Hogan had the idea to toss Warrior out to the floor, and he and Slaughter would fight in the corner, and the Iron Sheik, who was there as Colonel Mustafa, would go out and break the Warrior's leg. But Vince McMahon ended that talk right there. He didn't want a lawsuit on top of everything else. Again, this is Hogan, so it probably didn't happen. But instead, Warrior grabs a chair, and he chases Mustafa and Adnan to the back. Hogan and Slaughter finish the match in the ring. And once through the curtain, Warrior is told that Vince McMahon is waiting to meet him. Again, either that or he was handed a letter. I always did think it was very strange how Warrior didn't come back out after the match was over to celebrate. Instead, it was Hogan and Sid Justice, who was the referee, you know, celebrating to end the show. Warrior never came back out. And that's apparently because he was handed that letter that basically suspended it. But in that letter is where Vince said, you are a legend in your own mind, and he suspended him for no less than 90 days. It showed that Warrior just didn't understand, as performers sometimes, they believe in their own persona so much they can't tell the difference between the two. And there was a lot of discussion here about how Vince McMahon's approval meant so much, and The Miz. I mean, almost, you could have timed it. They're talking about how people are always, oh, Vince McMahon's approval, it's so important, and they show the fucking Miz. I'm like, of course they do. Of course they show The Miz. So The Miz comes on screen, and oh, you know, you want Vince to say that you did a good job, it means so much. And Vince McMahon says that he and Helwig had an unusual relationship. They were both nuts back then, but Vince says, I'm not nuts now. I would debate that point. I would debate that point, but that's for another day. Vince is asked the question, did you think of the Warrior as a son? Did you ever look at him as like being a son? And Vince McMahon says, no, I have a son. He didn't say who that son was, of course, his son being Paul Levesque. But anyway, he said, yeah, no, I have a son. I didn't look at him as a son. Sam Roberts is not so sure that if Vince didn't realize that Warrior may have taken that letter less as a boss being mad, but more as a father saying that I like this guy more than I like you. But Paul Heyman says the entire world of wrestling changed in 1992. Steroid use and distribution was illegal, and it was seen as very scummy and immoral, and Hogan was going to be taking some time off. And Vince goes back to the well, and he brings back the Ultimate Warrior, WrestleMania 8. Huge reaction when that music hit and he stormed down to the ring. It was a great moment, his return to WrestleMania that year. But it was right in the middle of the whole steroid scandal, and he was noticeably smaller. Like, who put Warrior in the dryer and forgot to take him out? Smaller. Still in great shape, right? Still, got muscles and everything. He's not like a string bean, but you compare Warrior in 92 when he came back to Warrior in 89, 90, big difference. And in 92, there's a package that gets intercepted that was addressed to the Warrior's driver, and it contained growth hormone. Bruce Pritchard mentioned that Warrior had failed the drug test, actually multiple drug tests, and Warrior himself admitted to failing them. And each time he takes the test, he has to list what medications he's currently taking. And the first time, it was just Motrin. And by the time you got to October of 92... it's just this laundry list of medications for depression and anxiety and insomnia. And by November, he is fired for violating the drug policy. He and Davey Boy Smith both were fired because Vince, look, they knew the heat was on them from the government. All eyes were on them. Vince McMahon has never been more serious about his drug policy than he was in 1992. And if you need any more evidence of it, you just look at a lot of the physiques, and not just Warrior. You look at a lot of the bodies and a lot of the physiques and how they changed in that period of time, and you could tell how serious they were. The steroid Dark Side of the Ring special later this year is going to be very interesting, how they cover that. But Warrior moves out to Scottsdale, Arizona, and legally changes his name to Warrior so that WWE can't stop him from using it. He starts a school, Warrior University. Oh, I remember those commercials. Warrior University. Dana saw that there was a new gym coming to town. I don't mean Hellwig. I mean an actual gym. And it was owned by the Ultimate Warrior. And she, walked in with her resume. And it's like love at first sight. They both looked at each other. And it wasn't long after that, they ended up getting married. They talked about in June of 96... Warrior's dad dying, and his biographer, Chad, mentions that they were not very close, but it hit Warrior hard. And around that time, he started missing shows. That's just something you don't do. Vince McMahon is, this footage of Vince from 05, I think it was, talking about, Warrior hadn't seen his father in a decade and didn't care much about him, so it was a very weak excuse. You don't miss shows. That's like the cardinal sin in our business. And so he terminated him. And that's a very simplistic way of looking at things. For the end of his run in 96, Warrior did not start no-showing events because his father died. He had already no-showed at least two or three events before his father passed away. It was business. He pitched a fit over a licensing show where WWE was using his Always Believe slogan on some of their products, and he felt that that belonged to him, and he wasn't being paid for it. He had trademarked the slogan, I think, only a few weeks before that. And look, if they were doing that, then that's fine for him to be upset, but it was after the licensing show that he started to no-show dates. Not because his father, who he was estranged from, not because his father passed away. So the producers asked Dana where he got his very strong political views from at that time. That came after that when he started making speeches and going around talking at schools and such. And she says, well, she was kind of hemming and hawing. And, oh, you know, talk radio was big at that time. As if it isn't big today. But talk radio was big at that time. And Warrior was really into Rush Limbaugh. And they just kind of got each other. And it was on all the time in the house. Which I'm sure it was. But that's her reasoning for why all of a sudden we got the conservative Ultimate Warrior making all of these speeches. Blamed it on Rush Limbaugh. And they did air video, and I wasn't sure if they would do this on the A&E special. So I was pleasantly surprised that they did address the UConn lecture when he was in the conservative speaker phase of his life. But they also showed highlights of some of his very, you know, in some cases, very unsavory blogs at that time. And he talked about prejudice is not racism, prejudice is not bigotry, I am exercising my prejudice, not racism or bigotry. And another blog post where he said, every one of your American lives is worth more than the entire population of Iraq. I can relay a personal experience here because Warrior was invited by the Young Republicans to speak at Hofstra University on Long Island in 2004. And I, like a lot of other people, heard that, oh, the Ultimate Warrior is coming to Hofstra. And I didn't even know who was hosting the event or anything like that. I said, I'm going to go listen to this guy speak. Is this what he's up to these days? Let's go see what the Ultimate Warrior is up to these days. And it's an experience I'll never forget, you know, being in that little auditorium, which was not really that packed. I mean, there were a decent number of people there. But it was a very, it turned into a very contentious lecture, shall we say. It got off to a bad start when one of the first questions he had for everybody was, how many of you have read the great books of the Western world? And I don't remember a single hand going up. Maybe one or two did, but like nobody raised their hand. And then it's like he started cutting a promo on us. Like, not even tongue in cheek. Like, he was disgusted by this and he was yelling at everybody and people started laughing. And I'm like, oh boy. I'm like, this is getting off to a rip-roaring start here. But there was, and this was in the, I remember this was in the student paper at the time. There was one exchange where, you know, he talked about how 20 years from now, if you're sitting in the street with your tin cup, don't push it in front of me because, you know, the only thing that's going to be rattling is the teeth in your mouth or something like that. And he was yelling. I mean, he was yelling this and he was answering a student who had asked him just like a hypothetical question about the wealth gap in the U.S. That was his response to that student. And this went back and forth. During the Q&A portion, they had students can come up on either side of the aisle, and they had a microphone. And another student came up and asked him a question about steroids. And I don't remember the exact question, so I can't say for sure. I don't remember it being like a trolling question or him trying to like insult the Warrior or anything like that, but he was asking him a question about his career and about steroids or, you know, his use, or did he ever use them? And again, Warrior just flew off, like roid rage. He like flew off the handle and he said, you know, if I put you through a table right now, you tell me if, you know, I don't remember. But again, he was just completely unhinged. But then yet at the end, when people started coming up to like take pictures and shake his hand and stuff, he had this big cheesy smile on his face. Like he was looking like a used car salesman and just he looked like the nicest guy in the world. It was like a switch got flipped and he went from this crazy maniac yelling at everybody in the friggin' room to casually chatting and shaking. Like it was all an act, except I don't think it was. It was a very bizarre experience. But back to the special. He says his infamous quote at UConn, which I'm not going to repeat. And we see somebody in the audience calling him a student, I assume calling him a gutless piece of shit. You need to apologize. And, you know, his wife claims that she was really disappointed and that Warrior knew he messed up. And this is where the whitewashing was kind of noticeable in the special. We can't ask the Warrior if he really did regret those words that he said, if he apologizes for any of them or some of them, or because he's not here. And his wife wants everybody to think that he did. he did regret the words that he said. But he never once publicly apologized for any of the things that he said. There's zero evidence of this. We have to just take her word for it. She claims that he was a changed man and that he did regret a lot of the things that he said at that time. But it wasn't just political stuff that he was ranting and raving about. He said some really egregious shit that if they would have covered any of it in this documentary, there would have been absolutely no way to paint him or it in a positive light. You know, after Heath Ledger died, he went on about the Brokeback Mountain. Clearly, he wasn't a fan of Brokeback Mountain, and that's fine. That's certainly his prerogative. But he's going on about the Brokeback Mountain movie that he did, and he said, "I do have to agree that he was a great father, perhaps even greater than the father of the year, Hulk Hogan. After all, Leather Hedger did what it took to kill himself. His kid is without a father, yes, but the negative influence is now removed, and his own child has the chance for a full recovery." Or when you go on your website, as he did at the time, and you write about Bobby Heenan, who was battling throat cancer. And I'm going to quote here. "It's just too difficult to keep a straight face talking about the pure two-faced bag of shit that you are and always have been. What with you also actually wearing one as a piece of body jewelry. You are dying, diseased on the inside, and no more time is left to get back any of the integrity that matters the most on death's bed. Imagine what it will be like lying there taking in your last breaths, knowing you hoard yourself out your whole life and had to, in your final years, be faced with emptying your own personal shitbag, affirming to you the true value of what you achieved in your life. Not even Vince could come up with a better finish than this. Karma is just a beautiful thing to behold." There is a difference between not liking the man, whether it's Heenan or whoever, there's a difference between not liking the man and being upset that he, you know, said mean things about you on your DVD and airing your personal grievances with him and then writing something like that and taking glee in another man suffering like that. And I would like to think that he was a changed man there at the end of his life. I hope for his sake that he found that peace, because that is an awful lot of anger to carry around. Talked about the self-destruction of the Ultimate Warrior DVD. His wife says that she didn't watch it, but Warrior did, and it broke a part of him that she was never able to fix. Hall of Fame, he gets inducted by Linda McMahon. He's there with his family. He makes a nice speech. Chad, the biographer, talks about how WWE had tried for years to get the Warrior into the Hall of Fame, and he always said no. And Vince McMahon says that, for whatever reason, this year was the year that the Warrior decided to say yes. They never mentioned in the documentary, but if Warrior's brother is to be believed, a few years back, he posted online, he said the Warrior was basically broke and out of money at the time, and he confided to him that Dana was ready to leave him because all the money had dried up. He had no money left. So accepting a Hall of Fame induction and getting back in bed with WWE may have been his only way of making money again. If that's the case, it would make sense why all of a sudden, after so many years of saying no, he finally relented and went back. I mean, we'll never know for sure because we can't ask the Warrior himself, but that's what his brother said. Dana, to my knowledge, has never responded to those allegations. So they get into Hall of Fame weekend. They had footage of Hogan approaching the Warrior. They had a little meeting in the hallway and they shook hands and they apologized to each other. And, you know, they hug. And Dana says that Warrior wanted to repair things with Vince and show him that he had a family now. Monday Night Raw, his big promo in the ring. Nobody knew it was going to be his last, except maybe him. And Dana says they were heading to Phoenix the next day for spring break, and Warrior told her he didn't feel too good. He needed to go to the hospital. And when he said that, she knew that something must be really wrong. And they didn't, I mean, they barely made it out the door before he just dropped. And she said it was like an oak tree and I couldn't catch him. And they took him to the hospital. They pronounced him dead. And she had to go tell her kids who she had left at the hotel. She thought she was protecting them by leaving them behind. And now she wonders if she robbed them of a final moment with their dad. And Paul Heyman says at the very end here, the tragedy is that he finally found the love and put away the hate. And that's when his heart gave out. So it puts a nice button on things there at the end. It was very sad what happened to him. Very, very sad. And very eerie. That after all these years, he comes back and he makes amends and he gives that speech and he gives that promo. And then he drops dead. It was a very sad sequence of events. It's very sad that, you know, two young girls don't have their dad anymore. This was a little more honest than I thought it was going to be in terms of some of the stuff they covered that I thought they would just completely ignore. And I think between that and the access to some of the footage they had that Darkside didn't, I just came away from this enjoying this more. But they both suffered from not covering... I know you can't literally cover every single thing he ever said or ever did. You know, even with the 2 hours that A&E had, they had a little more time so they could get into a little bit more. But there were some pretty important things I think would have been worth mentioning that they didn't. And again, both of them completely ignored. You would never even know he went to WCW. I know he wasn't there very long, but I did think that it was worth at least mentioning. And they didn't really get into that. So I think if you were to watch both of these, you would probably come away learning some stuff about him that you didn't know before. You'd also be spoon-fed some stories that just are not historically accurate. But that is to be expected because you are getting the WWE slant on some of this stuff. And it's a frustrating thing because, again, for all the stuff that he said in his later years, you know, if his wife is to be believed, he was a totally different man there at the end, even though there's no public indication of that being the case. You can't ignore the stuff that he said. You can't just wash it all away by taking her word and saying, well, I guess he just didn't believe those things anymore, and he takes back all of it, and it's all forgotten, it's all water under the bridge, when WWE has basically taken this guy, and it's like they've lionized him. From the Warrior Award stuff, which is a very nice thing for them to do, but they have co-opted the Ultimate Warrior persona and name to be something that was not always reflected in the way that he conducted himself in his life. And it's understandable why people would take issue with that. He was a flawed man. And that is the story of the Ultimate Warrior. I'll have a review up next week for the, I'm sure, very dark, Dark Side of the Ring on Grizzly Smith. Leave some comments. Let me know what you thought about not just Dark Side, but if you saw both documentaries, what you thought of them, which one you thought was stronger and why. I want to hear from you guys. And I will be back with a brand new review next week. So until then, take care, guys.